Welcome to the Blue Plaque Pod. Andrew Cotter, who's my guest today, is a Scottish broadcaster working primarily for the BBC. He commentates on golf, rugby union, athletics, the boat race and tennis. He's also known for his two very good dogs, Olive and Mabel, whose antics he filmed and commentated on during the COVID-19 pandemic when there were very few other sports to talk about. Welcome, Andrew.
How are you? That sums me up. That's me summed up in a few lines there. Well, you could have summed it up in just one line. He owns a couple of dogs.
Very good dogs.
Well, yes, no, they are. Very, very good dogs. The bestest dogs.
Firstly, because this is a podcast all about blue plaques, would it be possible to introduce yourself in the style of a blue plaque? So the first thing we need to know, obviously, is where this blue plaque is. Is it on your childhood home, your birthplace, your first place of work? Where are we looking?
Oh, that's a good question. It would be in Troon, probably. Are you allowed many blue plaques? You're just allowed one, aren't you?
People do have multiple. I think Gladstone has about five or six.
Yeah, come on. Well, I'm certainly at the level of Gladstone. Did he own two good dogs? No. It would be in Troon, probably. And there are a couple of homes in Troon. Not that we owned a couple of homes, but it's just lived in different houses in Troon, in Ayrshire, in southwest Scotland. And I would say Andrew Cotter, man who got away with it for many years in broadcasting, lived here from such and such to whenever. Actually, do you know who it was? Olive and Mabel would get the blue plaque, wouldn't they? So that would just be down here in Cheshire. I live in Cheshire now. So it would be in one of the two houses where they have lived. Olive and Mabel frolicked and gambled here and ate their breakfast here while somebody commentated on them.
Maybe you could all three of you have an individual plaque each, so it'd be a multi-plaque house.
Yeah, so a blue plaque on a kennel down in Devon where we got them from, saying Olive and Mabel were born here. Oh, I'm getting quite weepy now.
What an emotional start, and this is only the beginning.
But that's what blue plaques, you know, they're just a plaque on a wall, but they're the starting point for discovery and the telling of the story of those people. It's just, that's why whenever I used to walk through the streets of London, Rothmacdell, and whenever I used to walk through London, you know, and you just see a blue plaque up in a house in central London, whatever, because there are so many in London, and you go, I wonder who that fellow, I wonder who that woman was, if you are unfamiliar with the name, and then you look them up, and it opens a whole new world of knowledge, and they're like, I think they're wonderful things.
They are amazing. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, is because I think they are just little windows into lives. And I think there's something so wonderful about having that connection with place and then sort of going through time and experiencing different lives. And which brings us on to your plaque pick, which is in London, in Teddington. I looked it up this morning to have a look and have a little look at the street. And actually, the house that it's in is now the site of a sports injury clinic, which wasn't quite sure how to feel about that, given the person who we're about to meet. But it's at 82 Waldegrave Road in Teddington. And the wording is, Edward Whymper, 1840 to 1911, mountaineer, lived here 1907 to 1911. Edward Whymper, for those who aren't familiar with him, he was born in London in 1840 and died in Chamonix in France in 1911, age 71. And I sort of wanted to introduce him with some words that he wrote in his most famous book, Scrambles Amongst the Alps. Climb if you will, but remember that courage and strength are naught without prudence, and that a momentary negligence may destroy the happiness of a lifetime. Do nothing in haste. Look well to each step, and from the beginning, think what may be the end. So that's what he wrote in 1871. And he was sort of living proof of the dark truth of those words, because he was a 19th century English mountaineer and artist and engraver. But he was best known for his exploration of the Alps, and more specifically for being the first man to climb the Matterhorn. And this ascent of the Matterhorn was successful, but involved the deaths of four of the six men who went with Whymper. And it became something of a national and even international scandal. And in the wake of the accident, Queen Victoria sort of even got involved, and she asked her private secretary to write to the Prime Minister, Gladstone, actually, second time he's popped up in this podcast, determined to get a look in. So the Queen commands me, so wrote the private secretary, the Queen commands me to ask you if you think she can say anything to mark her disapproval of the dangerous Alpine excursions which have occasioned so much loss of life.
Yeah, but Gladstone replied, no, there's no real chance of that, to be honest. Because it's interesting that, because as long as there has been mountaineering, there have been people who've disapproved of it because they feel it's a pastime that's dangerous and something which is dangerous for no good reason, just for adventures and thrills. But that's a greater debate, which I firmly come down on the side of, if you're taking precautions and you know what you're doing, or that you're not risking the lives of others, that why shouldn't you risk your own life? Again, and you could say that we do so in it every day when we drive down a motorway. There are always going to be people who think that the outside, the outdoors and adventure is something to be controlled and safety measures applied, whereas I don't really see it myself. I don't see that sort of health and safety strictures of perhaps working in a factory or everyday life should apply to those who wish to go adventuring. But on Whymper himself, he definitely took a lot of risks, but all of them did. It's more the reason why they climbed at that time. And I think Whymper was seen as someone who was doing it just for the glory of climbing, of being the first to scale peaks, and he scaled a lot of peaks as the first person to do so in the Alps. Whereas before he came along, he was sort of the transition from, there were always people who climbed for pleasure, but mostly it was done for a sort of scientific research or because of just this absolute love of the outdoors, and that you felt that you're getting closer to your God in some way. Whereas Whymper wasn't about that. He was really just about beating others to the top of peaks, and I think a lot of people took exception to that.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. It's also interesting that his own quote is all about sort of safety and being careful and the difficulty, which I think is really interesting given what he's known for. Can I ask you why you chose this plaque?
I'm no great admirer personally of Whymper, but I love that time, the golden age of alpine mountaineering, as it was from, well, it kind of finished with his ascent, their ascent of the Matterhorn, the Taugwalders as well, the guides, and we'll come on to the others who sadly perished, but it ended in 1865. It had begun really about 10 years earlier, and that decade was this golden age of discovery in the Alps, because the Alps really was still a sort of undiscovered country, really, 1750 through to 1860, and thereafter it was mapped and it was discovered. But back then it was almost like the Himalayas were in the middle of the 20th century, really still wild and undiscovered and peaks unclimbed. So Whymper, there's no personal affection I have for him, but he symbolises that time. And most importantly, I chose it because I used to live in Waldegrave Road, and I had no idea that he had lived there. But I lived up the other end of the street, closer to the town centre, and 27, I think it was, Waldegrave Road. There might be a blue plaque there, I'm not sure. No.
Andrew Cotter lived here. Two good dogs and their owner.
Andrew Cotter lived here in a almost bedsit quality in 2001 to 2004. When I first went down to work in London in broadcasting, I spent about a year in Hampton, just a little bit further out, and then I moved to Teddington, had 3 years there. And I do remember walking down the street. It took me a while to see it because I used to be just driving down that road, heading into the BBC. But actually one day I was walking down to see a physiotherapist because that whole area, it's interesting you talk about it being a sports injury clinic. It's now dominated by St Mary's University as a real hotbed of sporting studies and physiotherapy, etc. So I used to go and see a physio in St Mary's, and I was walking down the road and I saw this blue plaque on the wall. I went, who lived here? Because it's really sort of suburbia, quite far out. You don't find that many blue plaques out there. And I think Benny Hill lived in Teddington for a while, though. I didn't check to see if there was a blue plaque. I think there is a blue plaque, actually, for Benny Hill.
There should be, if there isn't.
So I could have chosen Benny Hill, and instead I chose Edward Whymper, because I saw this plaque and I thought, oh my goodness, Edward Whymper, first man to scale the Matterhorn, lived here. And so that's why I chose it. I don't think it would have been a very happy home for Whymper either. He wasn't a particularly likable character, Whymper. He was quite difficult. And when he did all his climbing, all his great scaling of the peaks, including the Matterhorn, he was in his early to mid-20s. When he was there, he was towards the end of his life. He'd married a woman who was 45 years his junior, and it was a marriage because he just wanted to. He wanted an heir. It wasn't a well-suited marriage. It wouldn't have been a happy home at all. But that's what the blue plaque does. It makes you look and, I wonder why he was here and when he was here, what stage of his life he was here, or You know, it's like seeing Benjamin Franklin for a couple of years. Oh, he lived there for a couple of years. How bizarre. And so you look deeper into the biography of that person.
So because blue plaques, they're small and they're all about brevity. So something that I sort of wanted to do is sort of investigate people's lives with this podcast. But because of the kind of the brevity aspect, the way that I like to do it is by thinking about three key moments in the person's life, in the subject's life. And I think first of the three moments that I would choose is his first trip to the Alps, because as you say, they were seen as very formidable and forbidding in the 19th century. And it wasn't that long before the people had been convinced that this was a place sort of inhabited by dragons and witches and malevolent subhuman people. But by the 19th century, they become, you know, particularly to the British, this, you know, very important place and this kind of centre for this new sport of alpining. And, you know, there were all these peaks to be conquered. And Whymper, you know, he was born actually very close to where I live now in Kennington in South London. And I can tell you there are not a lot of big hills around here. And after school, he started working in his father's wood engraving business. You know, they weren't a well-known family. He wasn't from kind of the top echelons of society at all. Later took over as head of the firm. Again, no mountaineering in the career of wood engraving. I really like the fact sort of on wood engraving that his father's name was Josiah Wood Whymper.
Yes, that's nominative determinism at the peak. But I think you're right. I think, you know, his job, he wasn't from the upper levels of society. And Victorian exploring, British exploring was, of course, usually done by those who had the means and were able to just say, do you know what, I'm just going to head off for 2 months to the Arctic, the Antarctic, or to the mountains. And whereas Whymper, so I think for that reason, he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, perhaps justifiably so, because he was never seen as an equal by people who were members of the Royal Geographical Society, the British Alpine Club. I think he was looked down upon a little bit. So he just battered his way to the top of these peaks and said, by sheer force of will, I'm going to show you. Because for him, it was about achievement. It was about finding glory and status and achievement. It wasn't about, you know, I mentioned the scientific discoveries that were made in that time in the mountains. There was another great climber, a guy called John Tyndall, Irish man, who is, you know, if you look him up, he's remembered just for his scientific discoveries in terms of infrared radiation or magnetism or glacial flow. But he did it in the mountains. He made those discoveries in the mountains. He was there for scientific research, and so that was looked on as something more noble. Whereas Whymper, the reason he came to the mountains was because he was commissioned to do some engraving, some illustrations of the Alps, and saw those peaks. And for a man whose his brother was an explorer, and I think he wanted to be an explorer of the great wildernesses of, well, it would have been the Arctic more at that time, but he saw these peaks and thought, that might serve my, quench my thirst for exploration. And so that's why he came to it, really. So, but from the moment he started, it was really about that status and that achievement and probably being accepted. And I don't think he ever really was accepted in the way that he would have liked. So he was quite a dark character, Whymper. Again, not a particularly likable person, but you can see where he has come from. So it's an examination, really, of social class within Victorian Britain and Ireland, which was so clearly delineated and very difficult to cross between those various strata.
You've spoken about the dark aspects and we've already touched on, you know, some of the tragedy, but for me the second really pivotal moment in his life is the ascent of the Matterhorn. You know, he's in his mid-20s. He's already tried to reach the summit of this peak seven times. But in mid-July 1865, he hears that an Italian group, which is being led by a man that Whymper thought he had hired to guide his group, have set out to reach the summit. And he's livid. I say he's livid. In his words, he was bamboozled and humbugged. And
humbugged,
which is great. He snatches for a telescope, and sure enough, he's there. You know, in this hotel, and he can see through the telescope his rivals climbing up the mountain towards the peak. And so from that moment, he's determined to bring a group together and to see what he can do to beat them. I mean, for me, that moment, you know, seems absolutely incredible. You know, if you're already seeing your you know, this rival group halfway up. How on earth do you think that you're going to assemble a group, get all your provisions together, and then try and beat them?
Yeah, so there was various guides were used by all parties. Carrel had been used by Whymper before, but Carrel was Italian. There was there was nationalistic pride at stake as well, and yes, Britain absolutely dominated. The other countries hadn't particularly seen any need or necessity to go up these mountains in which they lived, the Italians, French, Swiss. The Swiss in particular thought this is just madness to be climbing up there for anything other than farming purposes. So to actually do it for just sort of a national glory was a strange thing. But then the country of Italy had started to come together, and France had started to emerge from, well, they still had other very different sort of matters to concern themselves with. So really it was the haste of assembling this party that was, I was going to say, the downfall, literal downfall, sadly, because a very amiable young Reverend Charles Hudson had appeared, and he announced that he had plans. He announced to Whymper that he had plans to climb, but he was so generous, Charles Hudson, that he said, why don't we join forces? Now, joining forces sounds like a good plan for a major attack on Everest or through the Arctic, but actually when you're looking to climb, to scramble, to rock climb, a smaller party is much, much more effective. A party of two, perhaps, is much, much more effective. A party of three, but a party of seven, as it became, is pretty unwieldy. And the real issue was that Charles Hudson had brought with him a young climbing companion, Douglas Haddo. There was Lord Francis Douglas as well, who also came in, and
he was a bit of a daredevil in his own right.
He was a bit of a daredevil, yeah, exactly.
He climbed the walls of Edinburgh Castle age 14 and swam the Hellespont at age 16.
Yes. He was still a youngster when he arrived. And in fact, he was the first one who suggested to Whymper that they join forces. So he was there, and he had Michel Croze, who was a guide who Whymper had used before. And so he said, look, why don't we all join forces? And then the real problem was that was Charles Hudson's young companion, Douglas Haddo. Sadly, Charles Hudson was far too generous in saying that, yes, he has good climbing experience, he's a good climber, he's done Mont Blanc, and he had done Mont Blanc, but Mont Blanc was not really a huge challenge. If you're fit enough, you could do it. But he vouched for his skills. And Whymper was so desperate just to have any attempt on the Matterhorn to try and beat the Italian party going up that I think he would have agreed to anybody at that point. And that was the problem as well. So that was his desperation for the glory was part of the problem as well, because Charles Haddo was not a good climber. And then the other factor was that they had lots of rope with them. They had lots of good rope. But for some reason, one of the crucial ties between two of the climbers was really, really poor rope. And ultimately, that cost the lives of three of them. I think one of them would have been doomed anyway in Haddo. But if you had good rope, then, and you had a strong enough belay, I mean, to get into the specifics of the fall. So they made it to the top. They made it to the top in record time.
In front of the Italians, they were sort of 200 feet, I think, from the summit when they realised the Italians are way below them. They reached the top in this shower of jubilation.
Yeah, this very cruel thing of throwing boulders down at the Italian party and sending them scurrying back to Cervina, which is extraordinarily dangerous thing to do. But they were whooping and hollering from the top of the mountain, and so they knew that the victory, because that's what it always was to Whymper, was the victory was theirs, but getting to the top of the mountain is so often so just a fraction of the completion of the task, getting back down safely. Because the adrenaline, the excitement of getting up carries you up, and then you feel rather weary once you've got to the top. You've got to get down. Your mind switches off a little bit. So they're trying to take every due care and attention going down. But there is fatigue. There's mental fatigue. There's mental relaxation a little bit. And then there is poor old Douglas Haddo, who's not a good climber. And down climbing is more difficult. You just can't see where you're putting your feet or what. Everything is against them, but it still should have been more than doable. Then there was this slip. Michel Croze, the guide, had just put his axe away for a moment, just aside. And at that moment, Douglas Haddo slipped from above and took him out. But then as Tugwalladr, the father and son, Peter Tugwalladr, they jammed in to try and belay. And if there was good enough rope, it would have saved them. But Croze and Haddo were slipping. And then they took out Hudson as well, and Lord Francis Douglas. And, you know, that's a horrific thing to for Whymper to have witnessed as well. Because really, this was, however the parties have come together, this was essentially his party, because he was a man of great achievement in the Alps. And he'll watch these four men slip away and gone over the edge, 4,000 feet down to the bottom from where they were. So a horrible thing to witness. And actually the Tugvalader, father and son, they were absolutely catatonic. They couldn't move for half an hour. They were just believed that they were all lost, and Whymper had to talk them into resuming the descent. And eventually they got back down. But then come the repercussions, of course. And
I think it's the repercussions that I selected as my sort of third turning point, because you have this awful moment, this awful accident, and it really is the work of a moment. I think in his recollections, he says, "I heard one startled exclamation and then saw Croz and Mr. Haddo flying downwards. In another moment, Hudson was dragged from his steps and Lord F. Douglas immediately after him. All this was the work of a moment. We held, but the rope broke midway between Tugwalder and Lord Francis Douglas. For a few seconds, we saw our unfortunate companions sliding downwards on their backs, spreading out their hands, endeavouring to save themselves. They passed from our sight uninjured, disappearing one by one, and fell from precipice to precipice below, a distance of nearly 4,000 feet. From the moment the rope broke, it was impossible to help them." You know, he spends a lot of time after the accident revisiting it, giving talks, giving lectures, explaining himself. There's a lot of blame and quite a lot of shame. And he seems very focused on trying to evade the blame. At one point, there's an investigation into whether the rope didn't just snap, whether it was kind of, it had been cut, not by him, but by another member of the party.
Yeah, Tugwalader the senior, yes, which, you know, was just nonsense. But it's amazing how these, you know, in the aftermath, and you talk about the blame, that even more sort of sinister conspiracy theories grow. So, yeah, but it was a...
Particularly because there were, you know, two of the people who died, Francis and Hudson, were so popular and had such an incredible reputation. And there was almost a feeling of, why did they die and why wasn't it you? Particularly as you were the person who were leading the expedition, you were the person who was in charge. And it was very much, you know, you were the one who was making the decisions, making the calls, and the responsibility ultimately should be yours. And yet he spent so much time trying to spread that blame and to evade that blame. I think that made him, you know, even less popular with the general public, it seemed.
Yeah, that was a continuation of his personality. I mean, even before the Matterhorn accident, he had spent a lot of his earlier life sort of dismissing the achievements of others, or he was very, very critical of various guides and of various other climbers, and dismissive of their achievements. Or so he, again, he, the fall of the Matterhorn was the sort of culmination of that quest that he had to prove himself, if not better than others, at least the equal of those who perhaps, you know, were looking down on him or not accepting him. And he just wanted that achievement and that approval and acknowledgement, and that ultimately leads to his haste to get this really ill-suited team, unwieldy, large team together with at least one member who is very, very unsuited to it, and not check as well when they were roping up on top of the mountain, not check they were using all the very best rope. The trouble is, in those days as well, there was a bit of a feeling that rope was rope, but the rope that broke is in the museum in Zermatt.
It's fine. It's like a washing line.
Exactly. It's very, very thin indeed. So there were lots of factors coming together, but the overriding factor is that desperation to get there. And the desperation to get there leads to all the other sub-factors that were, you know, contributed to the accident.
What do you think that he would make of the way that he's been commemorated? You know, he wasn't appreciated in his lifetime. He has this rather sad death where he, you know, he's in Chamonix and he becomes ill. He locks himself in his hotel room, refuses to let anyone come in. He has this very unhappy relationship with his wife. He's, you know, convinced that she's just in it for the money. Well, you know, he was 40 years her senior and by some accounts made her have a chastity test before their marriage.
I know, it's extraordinary. The wedding itself sounds like the most horrific, horrific day. I think his life is ultimately, you know, you say Whymper was the man who climbed the Matterhorn, and it should be something of a man to be championed and celebrated in World War, and that's what he wanted from his life, I'm sure. But his life actually was quite a sad life, I think. And again, I don't think it was entirely his fault. Again, you look at the upbringing and the shaping of people and what makes them into the personalities they are. You know, I mentioned when he climbed the Matterhorn, he was 25, and he died at, what, 71? So that's a long period of his life then to reflect on things, and he says he did, he could see that fall for the rest of his days, and he didn't sleep, but he was an insomniac, whimper, and he did go on to do other things in terms of exploration, and his book, Scrambles in the Alps, was very, very successful, and is actually still considered one of the great mountaineering books, and... But I think his life is a rather sad one, and certainly when you come back to where that plaque is, how sad it would have been at the end with his marriage to Edith, and, you know, she might have been in it for the money, but of course she would have been. She was actually, you know, in terms of class, she was of lower class than Whymper. We talk about him being lower than the class of society that he really aspired to be in, but she was lower. So he looked down on her and just saw her as something to bear progeny, and as I mentioned, it was a totally ill-suited marriage, and... It would have been a rather sad and unhappy time spent in that house on Waldegrave Road.
Basically, he wouldn't make much, perhaps, of the way he's been commemorated. Perhaps he'd approve of the wording, but he wouldn't approve of the location.
Yeah, it's all that odd mixture, the fact that he would say, he said, oh, Edward, you have a blue plaque. Oh, that's great news. And I'm remembered fondly apart from that. Well, I mean, again, he's not a bad man at all, Edward Whymper. Far from it, but
deeply flawed.
Deeply flawed, and the flaws of character that led him to on this intense five-year period of climbing the peaks for the reason of I would just want to get, you know, look at it in modern terms. We all do things in modern society, so much silliness on social media just for approval, or just for people climb peaks now just to have selfies taken at the top, or just to show that, you know, they'll put it out in Strava, they'll put it on Instagram, that here I am at the top of this peak. So it's rarely done for just being on that mountain and in the silence and looking at the marvels of nature. Nature was something to be overcome and savage for Whymper, and I will beat it, and I will be on top of the mountain, and I'll beat all the other people as well. And you wonder if he... Only a couple of times in his life he did talk about the incredible vistas, but it wasn't really about that for him. So his flaws in character drove him to the mountains to try and achieve and to conquer. Yeah, so ultimately those flaws in character led to not his death, but the deaths of other. But I think the second half of his life was not one of great joy. Even I'm not sure the first one was one of great joy, but it was one of some achievement. But the second half of his life would have been one, I think, of great introspection. And I think he wouldn't be surprised, perhaps. He would be disappointed, but not surprised that he's remembered with all those flaws.
I mean, he doesn't seem like the kind of person whose character allowed him to be happy with much or content with much. And it's hard to imagine a situation in which he'd look at anything and just be, you know, feel unalloyed joy and pride. No.
But a lot of people who go to the mountains, and I would count myself in this, you're escaping from something. I like to escape into the quiet, and other people are escaping from, he's perhaps trying to escape from the strictures of his own birth and upbringing and life that had been, you know, when you talk about his father being a wood engraver, and so shall you be a wood engraver, and that's it, that's your furrow in life. But no, I've got to escape from that. And so that's what he was doing. And a lot of people who do climb the mountains are not people who are happy in conventional society. So the fact that he had flaws is no surprise at all. A lot of people who go to the mountains do have flaws, as people who live in conventional society would see it. But perhaps they're just, you know, they would see that maybe conventional society's flawed. So, but yes, a very an interesting character, Edward Whymper.
So this is a plaque that you've walked past and driven past many, many times in your life. It's, you know, this is a man and a story that you know well. Are there things about Whymper and his life that have changed the way that you think about your own work or your own life or your own exploration?
No, but although having said that, you know, when I just talked there about what are you getting from the mountains, and whenever I go to the mountains now, quite often I'll make a little film of it. And I think, what am I doing this for? Am I doing this for the approval of others? Because I quite often try and convince myself that I'm doing it for my own record, because I do actually like, you know, if I've had a wonderful day in the mountains, then I know I can look back in it on those videos Because memory fades or is corrupted, and you'll remember that being on that peak and seeing this. But actually, if you show it in sharpness, I remember recently going up into the Mamores just to the east of Ben Nevis and having a beautiful winter's day, doing a lovely climb. And I filmed it, I made a video, and I put it on YouTube. So that perhaps then is for other people to enjoy. I hope that's slightly more worthy than for other people to, for getting their approval, for getting their likes, for people saying, oh, that's a wonderful video. I would hope it's more for them to actually, and a lot of people do say, I can't get to the mountains, I used to, so I love seeing these videos, or the mountains are beyond me, so I'll thank you for taking me there, etc. So, you know, there's a little bit of approval there, but it's a nice thing for them to be able to see that. But I do sometimes wonder what I'm doing it for, but I think it is so that I have that record of it, so that I can, if I'm sitting on a plane or in my dotage or just going somewhere where I don't particularly want to be and I want to just throw myself into place where I was happy, then I'll look at that video and I'll remember very sharply then being in that place and looking out at the sky or the clouds or the colour of the light hitting the snow. So I think for that reason, that's probably most of all why I film, but it does make you question it, and certainly I can see a lot of what Whymper did. I can see a lot of that in other people, and possibly some of it in myself as well, because to a greater or lesser extent, a lot of us in all walks of life are looking for approval, for status, for reward, and so Whymper has just had failings like most human beings do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Blue Plaque Pod. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, leave a positive rating and review, and share this episode far and wide with people you think might enjoy it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Blue Plaque Pod. I'm on Instagram as @CassiaWrites and on Twitter as @CassiaSinclair. This episode was hosted by me, Cassia Sinclair, editing and audio production by Rob Burney at Made by DBM. The theme tune is Dawning Sprite by Lincoln Davis.